Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so you heard on Mike Scott's newscast about this police-involved shooting in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis yesterday. And I want to talk a little bit about that, particularly in the context of the video, the body cam video that is to be released to the public in Chicago with respect to the Adam Toledo police-involved shooting here. This was Katie Wright, the mother of Dante Wright, who was the 20-year-old who was shot and killed by a Brooklyn Center police officer yesterday, explaining from her perspective and her conversation with his girlfriend who was in the car and was not injured, at least no life-threatening injuries, her conversation sort of in real time.
Then I heard the police officer come to the window and say, put the phone down and get out of the car. And Dante said, why? And he said, we'll explain to you when you get out of the car. So I heard the phone get either put on the dashboard or dropped. And I heard scuffling, and I heard the police officer say, Dante, don't run. And then the other officer said, put the phone down, and hung it up. And then a minute later, I called and his girlfriend answered, which was the passenger in the car, and said that he'd been shot. And she put it on the driver's side, and my son was laying there, lifeless. And then I said, where are you? And she said, I don't know. And the other officer said, hang up the phone. She hung up the phone, and I called 911 to find out where they were.
And apparently they were picking him up on an outstanding warrant, and he jumped in his car. That's when the officer fired the shot, and then his car crashed into another car several blocks down.
Well, they pulled him over, as she says, because he had an air freshener dangling from a rearview mirror. The police haven't confirmed that. So the issue is, why was he pulled over in the first place? And then in addition to that, after being pulled over and identifying who he was, there's an outstanding warrant for something that hasn't been reported, at least that I've seen. And that's when apparently there was the back and forth, get back in the car, put the phone down, and I don't know. She sort of indicates he didn't take off, but the girlfriend says the police officer said, Dante, don't run, so that he did take off. And so, the whole what prompted the police to open fire, to use lethal force, is a little bit hazy to me, other than, what we know about that he was stopped, that he had an outstanding warrant. And then, of course, this has precipitated all sorts of violence and looting in the greater Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis area yesterday.
Yeah, they had 26 stores looted. Here's photographer from Care 11 News who's on the scene.
I'm Care 11's David Peterlins. It is just a little before, or a little after 11 o'clock, I should say, on Sunday night here. We are near the old Brookdale Mall. This is the Verizon store near the Walmart off of Shingle Creek Parkway. I'm going to turn you around here so you get a good look here. The inside of the store has been completely ransacked here. There's Hennepin County Sheriff's deputies going through store by store right now.
And we had looting here in Chicago. I mean, the Nordstrom on Wabash. Two, three men smashed in the big glass window there, grabbed some purses. One of the three was caught, but the employees that were working inside had no idea what was going on. They had no idea about this Dante Wright shooting. They were very surprised, so they took off too and ran. So right now, Michigan Avenue is closed from the Chicago River all the way to Lakeshore Drive, and everybody from the 19th District where we're at all left and is helping out downtown.
And so we're days away, apparently, before the public release of the police-involved shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo. But this what the video purports to show was explained in court the other day. And, you know, I mean, this is against the backdrop of a vigil for Toledo on Friday evening. And I can appreciate it. It's a terrible thing when a 13-year-old is dead. However, the Assistant State's Attorney, James Murphy, said that that Toledo had a gun in his hand when the police officer shot him in the chest, that he was told to drop it, that he stopped with his left side facing the officer, and he turned toward the officer, and that's when he shot the kid. He shot Toledo. So he has a gun. He's told to drop it. He turns toward the officer with the gun, and that's when he shot. His hands tested positive for gunshot residue as well, indicating that perhaps he had been. It wasn't just the guy that's under arrest right now. Perhaps he had been,
operating the
weapon earlier.
Right. Police were called to 24th and Sawyer because their shots were fired. And Ruben Roman, the 21-year-old who they let go, Dan, on his own recognizance. And of course, he didn't show up for court. So they arrested him on Friday. Then he went to court. But he said that, no, the gun that Toledo had wasn't mine. That was his own gun. And I have a really good friend who saw the video and said, yes, Toledo, they're ignoring commands, drop the weapon. A foot pursuit went into it, ended in an alley near a fence, and that's when he turned around, and as he was turning, he was shot in the chest. But there's a still picture that there's not a gun in his right hand or a gun in his left hand, and they're afraid that that is what's going to be blown out of proportion, and then that people will start rioting in Chicago. That's why some businesses are boarded up on Michigan Avenue.
You mean remain boarded up?
Yeah.
Have they ever stopped being boarded up for at least for the last year? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Also, it was reported that the police video will be shown to the Toledo family before it is released publicly. And that's all well and good, but the sort of lionization of this kid before we really know the facts. And, again, civilian political authorities doing their typical hedge, right? Lori Lightfoot doing her typical hedge about transparency and this and that.
And she's going to talk to the mom first.
And I've been very clear about this from day one, that transparency always matters, particularly in something as significant as a police-involved shooting. I'm going to be respectful of what Ms. Toledo wants to do. She will have the opportunity to see the video along with her counsel early next week, and then we'll go from there.
So they're going to show it to the, you know, with the attorney and the mom, and they didn't do it this weekend because, yes, he was laid to rest on Friday and Saturday. But this kid, this 13-year-old who should have been in school, was reported missing 2 days before he was reported missing, and then he came back home, and then he was gone again, and this family didn't know that he was involved in the shooting because he runs away a lot. So they weren't, that was, you know, because people keep saying, well, they didn't care. The police didn't find the mom. Well, the mom didn't report him missing, too. So
what was the protest, the car caravan that went from the west side to the Gold Coast? What was the vigil? I mean, is it to remember his life or is it to say he was a victim of police violence or some such thing like this? Do police deserve the benefit of the doubt here? Because I just find it a bit troubling, to say the least. If Adam Toledo had killed police, we wouldn't be lionizing Adam Toledo. We would be mourning the police officer. Because the police officer, and if this description that was provided by prosecutors in court, if this description holds up, what is our reaction to the police officer who shot him? Do you think he was out hunting Adam Toledo? He was looking for a 13-year-old to shoot? So what is our reaction? It's a terrible thing that a police officer had to do, and I'm sure that police officer is going to be haunted by that terrible thing he had to do if everything checks out. But what's our reaction? All the focus is on Adam Toledo. We're going to defer to his mom, and I'm sorry that she lost her son, but I'm even sorrier that she had a son that was playing with guns on the street and didn't apparently comport with a police officer's command to drop the weapon. He's old enough to know better. He's obviously street smart enough to be hanging around with goons like this other guy who's under arrest.
Yeah, he had a Latin Kings tattoo recently. put on his arm to show his allegiance to the gang.
How are we to understand this?
I don't know. I mean, the media, too, the picture they're using of him is a complete different picture that I have of him. That's a picture of him in sixth grade instead of not, you know, he's a 13-year-old.
Of course. This is you know, Trayvon Martin when he's 8 years old.
Right. Yes.
So how are we to understand Adam Toledo and the police if what was described in court checks out? That's what I want to know. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line. Jim on the south side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning.
Okay, I'm a retired Chicago police sergeant, and policemen have to make decisions in a split second. And this kid put himself in a bad position. I mean, God rest his soul. Nobody ever wants to shoot or kill anybody. But the problem is the way that the mayor, Lightfoot, in my opinion, and the governor, in my opinion, they're vilifying the police, and even the state legislature, the Black Caucus, has said that their actions, the police are always bad guys. And if the police weren't enforcing the law, if the police weren't chasing people, we won't have a crime problem. And that's the mentality. And we see the after effects of it with how businesses are leaving Chicago, citizens are leaving Chicago and the state of Illinois because they don't want to become victims of crime. It's very unfortunate that our society has gotten to this point. But this is where we're at. And if the city of Chicago comes out with a policy, do not chase, that's a beautiful thing. You know what? You cannot chase somebody. If there is some liability involved, it'll be all on the city, not on your officers. And starting July, their body mounted cameras in Chicago say something different than the case report. I would advise all officers to put down, see body mounted camera video, three-line narrative. Respond to the call, see the video, that's it, because anything and everything they can do, and I'm not saying there's not some police in there that don't use good discretion and some police in that are a little, shouldn't be on a job, but for the most part, they're vilifying everybody because of a select few. And we're going to suffer consequences. The whole society is going to suffer consequences. So that's just my opinion. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
And also, too, Lightfoot said, you know, we're going to find out the person who put that gun in his hand. So blaming the weapon, you know, and not the kid, his own responsibilities. When you're right, Dan, he's old enough to know when the police says stop, stop, and turn around and drop your weapon. And the problem is that he was turning around and dropping the weapon at the same time. So that's where, you know, there's
his
some fear that there's
concerned
some
at all. Is mom concerned at all that her 13-year-old son had a gun in his hand? Concerned about that?
Got a tattoo on his arm. Moms know that when their kids get tattoos with Latin kings on it.
You want police to be videographers? Is that what you want? I mean, do you want to defund them altogether and just hire park rangers like Portland wants to do? Or do you want to turn them into videographers? They're just like reporters. They're just wearing a uniform. They're just there to document what happened. They're not there to ensure public safety. Well, when you take that attitude, you have a year like we did last year where you saw 55% spikes in homicides and shootings in Chicago, 38% spike in homicides in L.A., shootings up 40%, D.C., homicides up 20%, Philadelphia, homicides up 40%, Louisville, year over year, homicides up 70%, Cincinnati, wow. Homicides up 28%, Detroit, shootings and homicides up 53% and 19% respectively.
And what do all those towns
Providence,
have in
Rhode Island, homicides rose 13%, 18% in 2019, 2020, another 18%. Second straight year in Minneapolis. Highest tally since 1995, 84 shooting deaths last year. Cleveland, Houston, Indianapolis, Denver, Fresno. The 66 cities that responded to the Major City Chiefs Association year-end violent crime survey collectively saw 2,000 more murders in 2020 than they did in 2019. And the question is, what do you want to do about it? Nothing? You want to press down on the attitude towards police that put police on their heels and led to predators having the run of the place in major cities around America, including Chicago? What do you want to do? Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. A couple of questions, Dan. I'm not a lawyer, but think you are. So first off, they're going to release this video to the public, right? When does somebody stand up and say, for the greater public safety and common good, will somebody stand up and say, hold off on this video, let's wait till the truth comes out and it goes to court? But instead, I think they'd rather see the rioting and the burning of the streets because it fits our narrative of making the police look bad. It's a joke that they're going to board up stores and everybody's going to be held hostage again to this political socialist communist dictator that is the mayor. Can somebody stop this, Dan, in court and prevent this from being released?
No.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
I know he didn't ask me, but Laquan McDonald, that's what happened with, you know, Rahm Emanuel didn't want that released. And then when it was released, it was even, you know, I don't know.
Well, he's asking legally could it be stopped. You could try to enjoin its release. I don't think you'd be successful. What, you're going to get a Cook County judge to enjoin the release of the video?
No.
I mean, maybe. I don't even think. Even if Adam Toledo's family went to court, the public interest, the mayor's political position is just going to vastly overweigh any other concerns with respect to the release. I mean, and by the way, the case in Brooklyn Center, the Dante Wright police-involved shooting yesterday, there is body cam and dash cam video. None of that's been released yet, but you can expect that probably in short order. Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, good morning, guys. My simple question is, where's the BLM outrage and support for the 20-month-old that was shot last week? That's all I got.
Thanks for the call, Brian.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Before Mike Scott's newscast, we were talking about the forthcoming release of the police-involved shooting of the Adam Toledo, the body cam footage, and also the unrest in the greater Minneapolis area after the police-involved shooting of Dante Wright yesterday, a 20-year-old young black man. We don't know the race of the officer, not yet at least. Does it matter? I don't think it's going to matter in terms of the response from the Marxist Black Lives Matter race racketeers. It won't matter.
No.
You know how I know? Because here's another Anatomy of the Purge story. Jackie Lacey. Jackie Lacey is the former Los Angeles County District Attorney. Jackie Lacey is a black female. In fact, she was the first black female to serve as L.A. District Attorney since the office was created in 1850. But Jackie Lacey wasn't quite permissive enough. She wasn't quite as much of a non-prosecution prosecutor as your Kim Foxes and your Larry Krasners and your George Gascon, who defeated her in a primary, backed by George Soros' money. After the mayor of L.A., Eric Garcetti, rescinded his endorsement, Adam Schiff rescinded his endorsement of Jackie Lacey. Why?
Why?
Because she was a little bit too tough on crime.
Okay.
She resisted efforts to more dramatically reduce prison populations in L.A. than the Marxist race hustlers want to reduce them. And the protesters showed up at her home one day to demand, you know, a meeting with Jackie Lacey to petition her with their bill of particulars. And her husband greeted them at the door with a weapon, brandishing a gun, telling them to take off. They caught it on video.
Right now, get off.
Good morning.
Get off of my porch.
Shoot me?
I will shoot you. Get off of my porch.
Can you tell Jackie Lacey that we're here?
I don't care who you are. Mm-hmm. Get off of my porch.
We will get off your
right
porch.
Now.
Can you tell
we're
me?
Calling the police right
Good.
Now.
Good. Wow. He pulled a gun and pointed it at my chest.
Oh, no.
We're here for the community meeting, Jackie Lacey.
Jackie Lacey,
maybe you'll
go.
Shoot me in the back.
And so now he is seeking, he was arrested, charged with assault and unlawful use of a weapon. He's seeking a diversionary program to avoid jail time. He's a black man, married to Jackie Lacey, black woman. As far as I can tell, they're Democrats. Why is this story so instructive? Well, on a number of levels. One, we know this isn't about race. We know that from how black conservatives are treated. Two, we know this isn't about party affiliation. Because Jackie Lacey was a card carrier. She's down with the struggle in L.A. with the rest of the leftist establishment there. She's just not quite radical enough. And so...
So they turned on her.
Yes, so they turned on her. And replaced her, by the way, with a white guy. George Casson's a white guy. You think this is about racial justice. You think
about
this
power.
Is about racial cohesion. You're doing something when you fall in line with whatever the protest du jour is, when you wave your Black Lives Matter sign, when you show up for a Black Lives Matter protest as so many guilt-ridden, ill-informed, cowardly suburbanites did in the wake of the George Floyd killing. And in so many other instances. And you think you're a good person. You're a bad person. You're a bad person. And I'm sorry, but it's about time that bad people who are exacerbating racial animus, who are tearing at the social fabric of America, who are hastening its demise as a functioning republic, it's about time that I don't care where you got your BA and I don't care what your household income is. You are a bad human being. And the more that you try to impress upon the world that you're a good human being just serves as evidence of just how bad a human being you are because you're indifferent to the consequences of your participation. You're indifferent to the fallaciousness of the premises from which you start that seem to justify your sentimental barbarism. When are people in sensible people who live around unreasonable people, unkind people, cruel people, when are they going to tell them just exactly where to get off? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line, because, oh, by the way, you know, this is a gun crime, is public health crisis, public health epidemic.
Was it a pandemic or an epidemic?
Well, it's been an epidemic. It could be a pandemic as needed. So could racism. Yeah. Rachel Walensky, she's the director of the CDC, don't you know? Racism directly affects the well-beings of the well-being of millions of Americans. As a result, it affects the health of our entire nation. The CDC director on racism. So when do we get the out of an abundance of caution, we're going to do a 2-week lockdown to stop the spread of racism? Because, you know, we brought it to you on this show. Damon Young, who's a contributor to The New York Times, columnist at The Root. White supremacy is a virus that, like other viruses, will not die until there are no bodies left for it to infect, which means the only way to stop it is to locate it, isolate it, extract it, and kill it. No more bodies left to infect. You have to locate it, isolate, extract, and kill it. White supremacy. Whiteness.
Is there a vaccine for that, too?
Locate it, isolate, extract it, kill it. Whiteness is a pandemic. That was the headline of his piece. Whiteness is a pandemic. That's just a little bit more aggressive version of racism is a public health crisis, an epidemic. Is it? I mean, how many times do we have to have a conversation about how you experience your life versus how ruling elites and race hustlers tell you the world really is before you are willing to confront your neighbors to say, you don't live that way. We don't live that way in this community. There is no race war. I'm not participating in one. You're trying to foment one, whether through ignorance or some other misplaced motive. And I'm calling you out. Is that going to happen? Are we just going to go the way of middle managers in corporate America, sort of milling about, bumping into each other, and just trying to get to retirement age so you can parachute out? And hopefully, you know, you are able to survive before we're over the edge. We just go over the edge for and leave it that to our progeny. That's heroic, isn't it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, this young boy that got shot, he was a product of the media. He was taught to hate the police. He was taught this at the foot of the media, the politicians, people around him. Parents not raising their children. One parent doesn't know where the child is. The other parent doesn't know where the child is. And the people that pay for it are the people that did what they were supposed to do, raise their children, sacrificed. We're the racists. We're the ones that don't. We are just vilified. There's no pushback. Everybody in the store yesterday I went to had a mask on. Nobody chose to say, I'm not wearing this anymore.
Well, I know what's happening. I know what's happening. They're right. Vilified and no pushback. Why? When?
Because we have no backbone, and we're almost against the point where we have to get a backbone, me included. I mean, I'm living my life. I'm avoiding it, and pretty soon I can't avoid it. I'll have to face it.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, appeasement. You know, I know that's the soft Republican. Go along, get along, appease. You know, if we appease, then they're our friends, and at least they'll leave me alone. You know, thinking about Chicago suburbs, that's how Grant Worley, he's such a prime example of this. I was talking about this to a friend of mine yesterday. Grant Worley's a perfect example. Surrender Republican in Naperville. He's on board for all the cultural Marxism. Fiscally profligate or conservative than anybody else down there, sort of just a non-entity, but he's got a name in Naperville. He'll be safe in Naperville because he goes along with the P-hat posse there. He goes along with the sentimentalist jackals. He'll be fine. And lo and behold, he got taken out last go around, didn't he? We'll go ahead and get somebody a little bit more reliable, a little bit more consistent, a little bit more ideologically committed, not just going along to get along. Jackie Lacey in L.A., same deal. Can't run afoul of the orthodoxy. I'm sorry. We appreciate your appeasement because it provoked us to be that much more aggressive, gave us the confidence to be that much more aggressive, and now you have outlived your usefulness. And that won't happen to you, though. It can happen to Jackie Lacey. It can happen to Grant Worley, but it won't happen to you or your kids or your relatives. Is that how it goes? Is that what you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And now we watch the race hustlers openly and notoriously enjoy the fruits of their extraction.
Oh, yeah. Do you see that little ditty there that the president or the founder of BLM bought in California?
Patrice Cullors, co-founder. She bought $3.2 million worth of home, including a $1.4 million home in the mountains outside of Malibu. Lily White, I might add.
Yeah, Topanga Canyon. It's beautiful there. I love it there.
But this is nothing new. Yeah. Oh, and they say, well, she made her own money because she had a bestseller a few years ago, and she's been signed on to do programming for Netflix and so forth. Of course she has. But what is the derivation of all her money? The race hustle. But this is what corporate America does, and here's where we are in corporate America, with corporate America as part of where we are in America, as we continue to essentially either avoid noticing or cheerlead the slide into oblivion. It used to be there would be some grievance manufactured, and then Jesse Jackson Sr. would come and boycott and protest. That was the shakedown racket. And corporate America was happy to pay off Jesse Jackson to make him go away, which is how he could afford homes like in California for his mistress, Karen Stanford. Remember her?
Yeah, and the baby. Yeah.
So this is nothing new. That was Jesse Jackson. Where did he get the money? From corporate America. That's where Rainbow Push gets his money. That's where Jesse Jackson Jr. gets his money. He exists because of white media and white corporate America. Well, it's the same thing with Black Lives Matter. And so they rake in $90 million from corporate America last year, and Patrice Cullors gets a Netflix deal, and she writes a bestseller, and she buys a seven-figure home away from the
black people.
and away from the indignities and the uncomfortableness and the violence of urban centers, where she's, you know, leading the struggle, though. She's leading the proletariat revolution, isn't she? Sure she is. And you, corporate America, you, P-hat posse, sentimentalists, are happy to watch this scam play out right in front of you because you're just that weak. You're just that pathetic. And you know who I'm talking about in your friend circles. People are just that weak and that pathetic to watch somebody take their wallet and celebrate spending other people's money. Celebrate the scam they're running. You're the bad person. I'm the good person. I got your stuff and I'm enjoying it. Oh, and by the way, we're going to run reparations bills down your throat too right after this. Don't think this is over. It's never over. Why would it be over? This is enjoyable. This is the path to power and prosperity. And so you think that because somebody treated somebody badly 50, 100, 150 years ago, that it's okay for different people to treat different people badly in present tense, people that had nothing to do with what occurred 50, 100, and 150 years ago. That's your philosophy. That's what you're passing down to your kids. Well, clearly you are. And this is why K through 12, well, pre-K through post-secondary education is in the state it is. And that's why America is, you know, going the way of the Roman Republic with about the same speed.
Well, I've been to a few BLM protests, and I brought my kids because they were like, oh, we love BLM. I'm like, really? Okay. So the second riot that happened here, I forget the dates now. It's all a blur. But I brought them with, and they had F America signs, and they were screaming. They're screaming at police, being disrespectful. And they said, can we go home now, please? They had had enough. I said, well, now do you understand what they're all about? This is a hateful, disgusting, despicable organization.
Steve in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. I was just wondering, are these the only two people that have been shot recently by police? Is there any perspective on this that we can have from, I don't know, a time period of some type?
You mean the number of
police?
In Chicago?
You mean like the number of police-involved shootings versus the number of shootings in general?
Yes. We're looking at police-involved shootings right now. There's two people we're talking about. How many other races, how many other people have been shot during a time period? If we had a perspective, maybe people would see that it's not just black people getting shot all the time.
Well, right. Thanks for the call, Steve. Yes, obviously these are sensationalized. I don't have. I know there's about 850 shootings so far in Chicago alone this year.
We're not even in the summer months yet.
And that's, you know, we'll do, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 shootings like we do, like we're used to. A person is shot every 2 hours and 48 minutes, murdered every 14 hours in Chicago, and that's 99.9% not involving police, as we know. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Resistance is futile. Are you ready to be assimilated by the Borg? Talking about vaccine passports. Doyle McManus writing in the LA Times. Interesting piece. The drive for vaccine certificates isn't a matter of government overreach by out-of-control Democrats. It's a product of the free enterprise system. It's being pushed by private businesses that want to assure their customers and employees that it's safe to come back to work. Is it any wonder that a cruise line would decide that having passengers die of COVID-19 aborted ships might damage its reputation? The authorities demanding to see your papers aren't jackbooted agents of the Biden regime. They're foreign governments, international airlines, professional sports franchises, schools and colleges, and soon perhaps your neighborhood restaurant.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So what's the problem? Right, it's the free enterprise system. So what's the problem? Are you ready to give up your opposition to vaccine passports? Go ahead and get yourself vaccinated.
Well, because people want to know, you know, if vaccinated people impact a restaurant's capacity level. So if you could only have 30% capacity, but then, you know, people that are vaccinated don't account for that, you know, as a restaurant owner, you want more patrons in. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the larger point is you're not getting into the restaurant if you don't have a vaccination passport.
Yeah, eventually. I have a feeling that we're heading in that direction.
But it's fine because it's the free enterprise system, right? That's the question. That's fine. It's private business leading the way, so it's fine. You know, like when private business leads the way in opposition to the Georgia voting reforms, when private business leads the way in support of federalizing elections, when private business leads the way, Jeff Bezos, for example, in support of the latest multi-trillion-dollar funny money Green New Deal scam that the Biden administration has unfurled. It's fine. It's the free enterprise system. They're leading the way. So, yes, it's going to be government policy, but it's the free enterprise system petitioning the government to mandate this or suggesting that this thing that the government has made available, the Excelsior, which just rolled off the showroom floor, for example, in New York, it's fine. I'm just saying, in order to come into ABC widgets, or in order to go to a Tony restaurant on the Gold Coast, you got to get your government thing there. But it's me, private enterprise, your local restaurateur, your employer.
Soon to be your school. Well, your university. I mean, Rutgers, Notre Dame.
Exactly.
The list goes on and on of universities.
Friendly university president, your friendly principal and school board. It's fine.
The CTU, now that, you know, because they released their list of demands, and one of the demands is all 16, 17, and 18-year-olds need to be vaccinated before they feel comfortable, before they feel safe in the classroom.
So what's the problem, again?
Well, some people can't take the vaccine because of allergies, and they're never going to have a normal life.
I'm not talking about the exceptions. Let's do be center mass here.
Well, you're not getting the vaccine, right?
The question... is it fine? If free enterprise leads the way, is it all good? Simple question. For example, cruise ships. St. Vincent. St. Vincent on Friday had a volcano. St. Vincent, which is an eastern Caribbean island, had a volcano erupt for the first time on the island for the first time in about 4 decades.
Horrible.
And here's how that went. CBS reporting.
Nearly 20,000 people are out of their homes on the Caribbean island of St. Vincent after the first volcanic eruption there in more than 40 years. The volcano sent a thick cloud of smoke 20,000 feet into the sky, spewing ash for miles. Cruise ships are evacuating people from the island, but only those vaccinated against COVID.
No vaccination, no evacuation. You get to stay and deal with the volcano. Joe and the volcano on St. Vincent if you don't have your papers. But it's
so
being
they can
led
stay
by,
there and die. And
but it's being led by lungs. It's being led by free enterprise. The cruise ships are saying we're only going to evacuate, only allow to board persons who've been vaccinated. So it's fine.
It's inhumane.
What do you mean? It's free enterprise. What's the problem? I'm confused. Where are our libertarian friends? Free enterprise. Where are those who have made the market their religion the way that the left has made government their religion, their church. The market is the libertarian's church. The state is the left's church. What's the problem? Dave in Wakanda, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. It's not free enterprise for your own bodily's choice for medicine or to take care of your own body.
No, you can do what you want. You just can't come into my place of business. What's the problem?
You can't go on a cruise. Can't go to buy tickets from Ticketmaster.
That's right.
So
well,
what's the problem?
It's kind of like back in the time when Jesus was. These people what's that disease? They were banned from the city.
Leprosy?
Leprosy. Exactly. It's kind of the same concept.
Leper Island.
If you don't conform, you're out.
Well, thanks for the call, Dave. You know, I wouldn't mind going to live on Molokai in the old leper colonies there, actually.
So maybe, I remember those guys. Oh.
Maybe I'll scope that out. But I still don't have an answer to my question. If it's free enterprise making the decisions, leading the way, private sector businesses, there's no problem. So why the resistance to vaccinations or vaccine passports? Embrace. So somebody tell me why they are otherwise opposed when this is just people who are private property holders in business or operating schools imposing these rules on accessing their place of business, their institution. There's no problem here, right? Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I understand the question to be a little facetious there, but my original point was in Nazi Germany, it was, you know, the biggest thing that people have a misconception about, it wasn't just the German soldiers following orders. It was the people in Nazi Germany who had been manipulated by their government to believe that the Jews were inherently bad and destroying their country. So it's very easy for these minds to be manipulated. My second point is that free enterprise, quote unquote, that is the biggest load of garbage I have ever heard in my entire life. If this was truly free enterprise, why haven't all these restaurants been open that want to be open? That's not free enterprise. These are businesses that have the right to now make their own decisions that they want the vaccine. What about for the last year and a half where these people have been begging for their own lives, for the lives of their families, for everyone to be open? What is it, a third of small businesses in the state of Illinois closed their doors forever?
Yeah, 7,000 bars and restaurants closed.
We're
still begging to get our kids back in school.
Tar and feather. Sick of this.
Thanks for the call, Clay. Appreciate it. He's getting to something with respect to how the state works to give the patina of free enterprise.
Right. Well, this is what Pritzker wants. He doesn't want to mandate a vaccine passport because then he might look bad, but puts the onus on the business owners
that's
to do it.
That's part of it. That's part of it. There's no question that's part of it. But nobody forced those CEOs to have a Zoom call about the Georgia election reform law over the weekend.
Saturday. Oh, my God.
So part of what Clay was getting at is part of a proper response, but it's only part of it.
Okay.
I still want to hear from the libertarians who attend the Church of the Free Market. And, you know, this is from a free market guy. This is from a guy who named his dog after Friedrich von Hayek, for goodness sakes. But I recognize that the market is not a is not a church. It's not my faith. The market is the best way to set up the interactions between free people. And I think some on the right are confused about this, that a free enterprise system can't lead you down the same road to serfdom. Now, you have to have the state, no question. But what happens when the free enterprise system, when you have the leading private institutions in an otherwise free society fold in with the state? Then what do you say? Huh? Their choice. Right? Joe and Tinley Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, I know you love movies. This reminds me of Rollerball with James Caan. There's no more governments. It's only executives and worldwide businesses.
It's good. That was a good movie. Thanks for the call, Joe. It's a good reference. Well, I haven't seen that in a long time. John Houseman, I think, was in that too. Very good. Sean in Aurora.
Morning.
Hey,
morning.
Sean.
I was going to say, if we're going to allow free enterprise.
Do we lose Sean? Sean? Oh, sorry.
Yep. Hello.
Yep, we got you. Go ahead.
What if we're allowing free enterprise to lead the way? What would be any different if we no longer allow gay people or black people in restaurants or people that have had abortions? They can no longer come in to business if that's what's wanted.
Right. Thanks for the call, Sean. Right, where private property rights begin and end with respect to exclusion. Okay. Lee and Hammond.
Hey, guys. Fascism, isn't the definition of that is a cabal between business and government? You know, the way I feel about it, I think you got to be an idiot at this point to think that this whole pandemic wasn't just something that the powers that be are using to force everybody into this great reset that they're trying to get total control of everybody over. You know, that's what this is. You know, it's business and league with these global governing authority, I think, that they're trying to set up.
Thanks for the call, Lee. Diversion, inclusion, and equity in all of these businesses, in all of the schools. Diversion and inclusion and equity programs, protocols, strictures, critical race theory, all the COVID restrictions. Out of an abundance of caution, don't you know? Keep people safe, don't you know? Yes. We're protecting you, don't you know? Yeah. Yeah, Lee. Isn't it? Isn't it when the entire civil society folds in with the state? Isn't it? And so the response? What is the response? What is it that can be taken from you? And this is, to me, where, you know, what they're doing is manifest. It's not like they're particularly cagey about it. They're doing it openly and notoriously. On all of these fronts and all of these issues we talk about and all of these institutions that, well, provide the foundation for a free society and also have most of the political and economic power. And so, as long as your friends get their $1,400 check every couple of quarters, everything's fine? What is it going to take? Or what is it going to take that is taken away from you before you don't just do that? Well, you know, I have a bit of a different view on that, but I don't want to make this gathering, whatever the gathering is, uncomfortable. I don't want anybody to feel awkward, so I'll just sit here passively while leftists who never feel awkward just drive their propaganda train right through the crowd. John in Crown Point.
Yeah, Dan, you know, if we take the mark of the beast, you know, we won't even need voter ID anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, and to get vaccinated, you do have to show a form of ID, whether it's a driver's license, ID card, or passport.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and one of the great philosophical questions that man has wrestled with for a time immemorial, along with what is truth, what is good life, what is the good life, the life well lived. Is there a God? And what is infrastructure? One of the questions that we continue to grapple with as human beings, as fallible mortal creatures. Jennifer Granholm is not such a fallible mortal creature. She's the energy secretary, and she is former governor of Michigan, incredibly. And she tackled that on Clinton Foundation Donor Zero's program over the weekend.
What is infrastructure? Historically, it's been what makes the economy move. What is it that we all need to ensure that we as citizens are productive? So we need roads, we need bridges, we need transmission, you need lights in people's homes and offices. You need to make sure that people can actually go to work if they have an aging parent or a child. This is, you know, as the president said this week, that infrastructure evolves to meet the American people's aspirations.
Yes. Infrastructure is ever evolving. You can't pin infrastructure down. And it needs to, so that we can stay competitive with our Chinese communist overlords. Jennifer Granholm knows this firsthand. She was part of a trade mission there, and she recounted last week a conversation she had with Chinese communist businessman about green energy, you know, per her rolling out all the magical green energy targets the Biden administration has, reducing the cost of solar by half over the next decade and adding 30 gigawatts of wind power to the Eastern Seaboard's grid and all these wonderful things. Because, hey, if we don't,
After I was finished being governor, I traveled to China to see their clean energy efforts. I was with a group, and we went to a city, and I was standing next to the mayor of the city in China, and during a demonstration, he leaned over to me and he said, "So, when do you think the United States is going to get a clean energy plan?" And at this point, and this was several years ago, I said, "Oh, I don't know. There's so much polarization. It's difficult in Congress to get consensus." And he just looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Take your time. Take your time." Because they saw our passivity as their opportunity.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's drama.
She didn't mention any of the, four dozen coal burning plants that they're building. I guess that wasn't part of that trade mission. For more on this in the context of the $2 trillion worth of funny money Green New Dealing, pleased to be joined again by our friend Jim Urio, no longer CNBC.
Oh, yes.
Market analyst, now Fox Business analyst. Jim, newly minted Fox Business analyst, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also, restaurateur, we should note, of course, Brandt's and Palatine.
Yeah, if you weren't going, I was going. You'd make sure of that, right?
I figured I'd beat you to the punch on that. Jim, you know, first of all, discard your antiquated understanding of what infrastructure means. And then secondly, open your mind to the possibility of this $23 trillion clean energy market that we're going to corner under the stewardship of Jennifer Granholm and Joe Biden.
But also, I mean, we're going to try to mirror China. And I think as long as we're doing that, we should probably mirror them in all kinds of ways. You know, they just seem like they got it all going on there. This is the thing about the infrastructure, how infuriating it was. And again, we on the show have talked about traps before. Like, they'll say the single most outrageous thing. And then if you come back and say, "Well, it's stupid, it's not infrastructure," they'll be like, "What, you're against child care?" Well, yeah, no, I am against the state providing any sort of upbringing of kids. There's no question about that. But if they can define infrastructure however they want, and you can make that argument that, anything that makes things, you know, go better and frees people up, then you can bring it down to anything you want. And, you know, nachos and hair care products are going to be infrastructure within the next couple of weeks. This is outrageous. And again, All these things I believe to be just traps. I think they're acting ridiculous on purpose. Andrew Cuomo giving $15,000 to every illegal immigrant, he just wants people like you and I to say, that's stupid, and then they can point to us and say, well, clearly you're against immigration. So, yeah, am I going to fall for it? Yeah, I'm going to fall for it. They don't know what infrastructure means, it seems like. I don't know if our school system's failed or they're just a bunch of morons.
Well, how much money is actually of that $2 trillion is actually going to improve roads and bridges?
I thought it was about 20%. And then, again, I was arguing with people, and I said, I know absolutely for sure that it's not an infrastructure bill. And the reason I know that is because they're calling it an infrastructure bill. And based on the history, anything they say, you can look to that bill and know that it's not what they said. So, I mean, it's outrageous. It's just, you know, it's just throwing money at things. And even, like, the notion that they can increase by tenfold money that's going toward health research, every bit of history on that is that when you increase a budget, a government budget like that, all that happens is that corruption goes through the roof. It's not, it's like people out there going, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. You'll throw more money at health research. It's just dumb. It doesn't work that way when the government does it.
And Jim, you're a bit myopic. You're not understanding the scope of the problem that this is attempting to solve. For example, we know from Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who apparently is the transportation secretary now. He's the guy who rides his bike at least, you know, right up until the meeting.
Yeah, smart.
Gets out of the SUV to ride his bike to the meeting. That guy. The national highway system is racist, predicated on racism. And so when you have to deal with racist highways and byways, you have to think more holistically. There has to be a certain gestalt to infrastructure that addresses not just the crumbling roads and bridges, but the racism underlying the roads and the bridges. And here again, Granholm said 40% of this plan, the benefits of this plan, which are dubious, would go to the victims of that they've so defined, you know, marginalized communities whose voices haven't been heard. So that's part of infrastructure, too, is giving people who are in marginalized communities, as defined by the government, their voices back in addition to dealing with those racist highways and byways.
No, and to keep people who are listening up to speed on this notion, this is not a new notion, and there is at least a couple grams of truth to it, is that when highways were built, they tended to take over land in poorer neighborhoods other than rich neighborhoods. And now the Democrats are contending that was a racist thing, but I mean, if you look at it from an economic standpoint, and again, this underscores the most important point about the argument between the two sides. If we were looking at where to build a highway, the question becomes, do we angle it through, you know, a poor, less developed neighborhood, we angle it through a rich neighborhood. It's obvious that for the long-term good of everything, you want rich neighbors. You don't want to destroy every neighborhood. But that's exactly the point, is that they want everybody to have equal, and the only way everyone can have equal is if they destroy everything. And that's a sad state of affairs. And it's absurd to start saying now that we're going to change the whole highway system based on its racism that was from 60 years ago.
Well, this is going to create 19 million jobs. I'm sorry, not 19 million, 2.7 million. Over the weekend, Pete Buttigieg again, not 19 million as he and Biden were saying, but 2.7 million jobs. It's a bit of a rounding error in government, you know, off by a factor of eight. 2.7 million jobs for $2.3 trillion. That seems like a great ROI.
Sure. And we want, you know, the government to be creating jobs instead of the private sector, because those are, you know, always going to be the ones that have the most future. You know, and again, like I was thinking of the whole high-speed rail thing, too. This is just so typical of our government in particular, is that we're going to start on high-speed rail. Now, by the time high-speed rail comes around in 10 years, every advantage that high-speed rail would have given us 30 years ago is going to be eliminated by artificial intelligence, machine learning, electric vehicles. Even in the West right now, there's freight that's being moved in trucks that are electric and have no drivers, or no drivers are going to be needed in those. So this is, it's so perfect that we are going to embark on these huge projects that will be completely antiquated once they're released. And that's just that's what government does, because they can't nimbly switch from project to project based on what is hot and what's new and what the consumer demands. And that's, I mean, again, there's no economist on the planet who wouldn't nod to that notion. And yet we're going to let the government just direct everything. It's just.
And there was a Wharton study of the American Jobs Plan, as it's called, a Wharton study. And it finds that any combination of the spend plus the tax increases that have been proposed, with or without the tax increases, any combination reduces the GDP of America, both in the short term over the next 10 years as well as in the long term over the next 30 years, reduces GDP. So how is it a jobs plan? How is this provided return on investment where under any scenario you contract gross domestic product?
See, we know for certain now, we don't have to debate what the left attitude towards taxes are. In 2008, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were debating, they acknowledged that raising the capital gains tax would, in fact, reduce the receipts from that tax. They didn't care. They didn't care about collecting taxes. And that Barack Obama's answer to it was, it's just fairness, meaning that if someone has lots of money, we should take that money away. So the point that I'm trying to make is that they know the corporate tax rate, take it from 21% to 28%. All it's going to do is get us reacquainted with the expression tax inversion as companies start to domicile in Ireland. And we knew that, too. Janet Yellen knows it's an awful, awful tax plan, and that's why she's been pleading with the rest of the world to follow our mistakes so we're not at such a competitive disadvantage. So,
which is not going to happen, by the way.
Of course, I hope it's not going to happen, too. I think, you know, when Walgreens announced that they were having a tax inversion back in the Obama years, I was like, good for them. I'm an owner of their stock. Money should go to where it's treated best. That's what she's trying to do is taking away the competitiveness of economics, and the whole capitalist system globally is built on competitiveness.
You're going to have You're going to have Ireland more than double its corporate tax to keep pace with America. Why would they do that?
I certainly hope not. I want them to take advantage of your opponents. And in the world of economics, you have to think in terms of, you know, allies are your sometimes economic opponents, as in the burger business. You know, guys, and these are my friends who have other restaurants in the Northwest suburbs. But at the end of the day, it makes everybody better to compete. And I hope to God that Ireland knows that.
The problem isn't too much money. You're using the wrong nomenclature again. Please use the accepted vernacular, Jim. It's not too much money. Excess profits is the enemy. Excess profits. We have to deal with excess profits through taxation.
Yeah, profit motive is not what fuels it. He doesn't believe in profit motive. He believes in the spirit of cooperation. Bernie Sanders has said that numerous times. Imagine someone who's never been in business, has never had a job, believing that, yeah, profit motive isn't what's really driving things. It's the spirit of cooperation, or at least we can move to that. That's, again, this is someone who's never had a job, and he couldn't be my dishwasher. He'd be fired after a day of spouting that nonsense.
Unionize the kitchen before you know it. Yeah.
Jim, as a restaurant owner, there's, you know, talk of having vaccine passports, but, you know, having that rely, the onus being on the restaurant owner. So would you ever require any of your patrons to show that they have been vaccinated in order to eat at Branson Palatine?
I mean, you're going to make me answer this question. I mean, this will never happen at Branson Palatine. Which is funny is that, you know, we have at Branson, there's a decent amount of older people who are patrons. And they come in and they talk about the vaccines and they're excited right now and they're so glad to be back out. And I'm happy as hell for them. I think that it's a great thing. But the notion that I'm ever going to prove my vaccination status to go to a restaurant, to go to a concert, to go to a play, that's never going to happen. And we're never going to require that at Branson. And as far as, like, I had a conversation with a police officer a long time ago in the beginning of this, and I said, you know, if you want to deputize me and give me one of those fat pensions, I'll start enforcing your rules. But independent of that, you pretty much got to come in here and take care of that yourself, because I'm not doing it.
I wanted to get one more review of a macro comment from you. This was Jay Powell on 60 Minutes yesterday talking about the economy and his concern that it may be reopening too quickly. Interesting.
What we're seeing now is really an economy that seems to be at an inflection point, and that's because of, you know, widespread vaccination and strong fiscal support, strong monetary policy support. We feel like we're at a place where the economy is about to start growing much more quickly and job creation coming in much more quickly. So the principal risk to our economy right now really is that the disease would spread again. You know, it's going to be smart if people can continue to socially distance and wear masks.
The disease that's spreading is people who can't stay in their lanes. Fauci wants to be an economist and Jay Powell wants to be an epidemiologist. But the larger point that he makes, no problem continuing asset purchases, no problem keeping rates low. And the only problem, concern, is obviously inflation, with his concern about reopening too fast.
Yeah, and it's funny is that, and again, this has been a criticism of mine for 20 years. This is nothing new, is the Fed's ability to spot inflation, which I jokingly refer to as the Wonder Bread Index, where they call the jewel every Thursday and ask what the price of Wonder Bread is, and they miss the fact that lumber has tripled. The yield curve, and again, I don't want to get too far in the woods for people, but the yield curve started to steepen, which is an indication of inflation, but that since then has kind of stabilized. And the reason for that is that the world's central banks continue to buy their own bonds and other people's bonds. The German 10-year yield is -0.35. So our 10-year yield can't go that much higher because there's an arbitrage between the two. So Jay Powell can look at the yield curve and say, the market's a little bit worried about inflation, despite the fact that he himself is also buying $80 billion a month of our longer-end debt. So I think that the notion that there's no inflation is absurd. There's clearly inflation. All I have to do is look at Florida real estate, lumber, yield curve, Bitcoin. Bitcoin is cryptocurrencies are a $2 trillion inflation hedge now. That if that money had been released into the other assets, imagine the bubble creating potential that could have. So Jay Powell and the entire Fed, and I'm going back several different Fed chairmen, they live in this world of academia where they believe that the CPI tells them where there's inflation, and they miss absolutely tons of other inflation.
Jim Urio, Fox Business Analyst, proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine. Jim, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Another memo from SecDef Austin. Combating extremism within the military ranks. Following up on the February 5th stand down that occurred to provide 60 days to address extremism across the Department of Defense. And there's now some remedial actions to be taken, including this. And I have a copy of the memo that I'm citing here that includes this. Thought crimes. Reading, following, and liking extremist material and content is one of the areas of work to counter. Line of effort number 4, education and training. Utilize the current extremist and insider threat training review. Examine existing training, make recommendations, use lessons learned from the stand down. Ensure training addresses issues raised by commanders and supervisors on gray areas, such as reading, following, and liking extremist material and content in social media forums and platforms. And of course, what's the problem there? It's not the gray area. It's the who decides what's extremist material. Is this going to be the Twitter standard, where anybody who has a question about anything related to CDC guidance on COVID-19 is reading is banned as a part of some extremist conspiracy to deny science? It's a real problem. We talk about the external threats to the nation, as well we should, China, Iran, North Korea, Russia. What about the internal threats of our own culture seeping into the military, not in just celebrated ways with things like the trans-identitarian politics, but with this purge that's going on across the identitarian spectrum? For more on this, pleased to be joined by our friend, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano again. Of course, he is the Vice President of International Relations at Heritage Foundation, author of a number of books, a West Point grad. Lieutenant Colonel Jim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks. And you know, I was in the military for 25 years, and what's shocking to me is, you know, I spent my entire career doing what I was taught and told, which was teaching everybody that what they were looking at was not somebody that was black or white or Asian or whatever. It was a uniform, and that uniform meant everything to them because that was a person that was going to have their back, that they had to trust. And I, quite honestly, I am incredibly appalled when I looked at the Chief of Naval Operations reading list and I saw that what passes for, you know, training, and which really encourages people to look at other people as different races and creeds, it really kind of, I think, undermines the whole purpose of selfless service and how we should look at our fellow soldier. And I'm really actually appalled at this, the extremist training, which absolutely, if you connect the dots, seems like a political education and political monitoring as opposed to respecting the rights and privacies of individual soldiers and keeping the military kind of out of politics. So it quite honestly is quite appalling.
And look, Representative Michael Waltz, who's a Republican from Florida, sent a letter to West Point Superintendent Lieutenant General Daryl Williams about information that he obtained from soldiers, cadets, families of soldiers and cadets about critical race theory being insinuated into cadet instruction as well. So, I mean, it is in every nook and cranny.
It's completely inappropriate. Look, so one of the books on the reading list and on DOD and the Chief of Naval Operations was this book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. I'm not opposed to people reading this book. I'm sure that the person that wrote that book is very sincere on how they view the world. But I don't think military people, you know, I read Soul on Ice. I read James Baldwin. But this is not the kind of book you give to people and say, read this book and understand this is how the world works and this is how you treat your fellow soldiers.
Exactly.
That is not right.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I can read Ibram Kendi or Robin DiAngelo the same way I can read Milton Friedman or Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams or Bob Woodson or anybody. It's not about ignoring the scholarship of those with whom you disagree. It's about incorporating it. But when it's taught like it's biblical, that's the problem. And that's exactly what's happening in pre-K through post-secondary, including the service academies and now the officers in training as well.
You know, the military's actually tried this before in the 1950s when we were gearing up for communism. We had this thing, well, we need to make sure people understand, you know, good from bad, and we actually started a program of political indoctrination in the military, and it did not end well. It did not end well at all, and it was quickly abandoned. And this is just not appropriate. And the sad thing, look, I'm in the military. I was in the military. It's, you work for the civilian leaders. The civilian leaders give you missions. You go out and execute. This is really on the civilian leadership, which, by the way, includes a former four-star general who ought to know better.
Right.
To not put the military in the crosshairs of partisan political squabbling.
Well, it's really shameful. Right, but is it personally insulting? Because it sounds like they're treating you guys like children.
No, the thing is this is the cancer. It's they think, well, you know, they want this in secondary. They believe this stuff, and this is what's really serious. I don't care you believe what you believe, but when you are imposing your partisan political agenda on other people as the truth, and then insisting that if people deviate from that, they're essentially a threat to society. This is very, very troubling.
And, of course, it is doubly troubling in a military, which is supposed to be nonpartisan, non-military. And the thing is, dude, take your uniform off, go home. Anything you want and think is, you know, disconnected with your military service, as long as it's legal, it's kind of your business. It's shameful to suggest that the government should, and the whole idea of, look, monitoring people's social account and be careful what you do on social media, that's for the professionalism of the service. That is not for make sure you only have politically correct thoughts outside of your duty. That's nonsense.
I wanted to get your take on another matter, the suspected cyber attack by Mossad against the Iranian nuclear program, and if it was Israel behind that effort to derail Iran's nuclear program, what that says about how Israel views the Biden administration's interactions with Iran.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who knows? Who knows? Certainly Israel is going to act in its own self-defense and always will. But the point is, first of all, we can't sabotage our way out of this problem. I mean, Iran has the capacity to become a declared nuclear power when they want to. I think this is one of the real fallacies of this whole debate, is people think of this as like there's some kind of assembly line. And when we put a lot of effort into this, you know, it slows the assembly line down. And when we don't, it kind of speeds up. Iran's built the infrastructure. They have the missiles. They have enough nuclear material. They have the weapons designs. Iran, the only reason they haven't declared themselves as a nuclear power is because they don't see it in their interest right now to do that. The preventing Iran from going nuclear is a political problem. It's not an infrastructure problem. Having said that, I mean, you know, could the, and this is all just conjecture, you know, could the Israelis be sending a strong signal like, dude, just because, you know, Biden gives you a get out of jail free card, don't think you're off the hook here. Are they trying to, you know, sour the negotiations between the U.S. and Iranians? Why would U.S. intelligence come out and acknowledge this? Are they going to go into this deal regardless of how terrible the Iranians are? I mean, the problem with this is, look, in a couple of months, Biden's going to be right where he is now. He's going to have a choice of either completely caving to the Iranians, going back in the deal, taking off all the sanctions and getting nothing, or he's going to have to just continue Trump's policy of sanctioning and isolating Iran. Just make the choice now, because you're just burning, you know, you're just burning oxygen here. We're wasting months where we could be focusing on the threat in this pretend game that we're actually going to get somewhere, because we're not.
Were you heartened at all by Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State Blinken's comments in the direction of China about Taiwan? You leave Taiwan alone or else.
No, it was actually a kind of a stupid statement. It says, we're going to help Taiwan defend itself, but we're not an obligation to defend Taiwan. Like, what the hell does that mean? I just thought it's the kind of statement that starts World War III. First of all, all the people that really track this, that I really trust, you know, don't think the Chinese are imminently going to launch an invasion of Taiwan. But, there's one thing that's actually been true in years in and years out. The stronger the U.S. supports Taiwan, actually the more stable the relationship between Taiwan and China is, because the Chinese actually respect the Taiwanese more. The weaker we are in our support of Taiwan, the more the Chinese take advantage of that. So I actually thought, you know, letting, you know, opening up to more senior officials to going to Taiwan is important. This administration actually has been following through on defense support. But I thought that was kind of a dumb statement, actually.
Well, it's consistent with the Biden administration policy, similar to Joe Biden's position on the All-Star game being pulled from Atlanta. He supports corporations. He supports Major League Baseball from pulling the All-Star game. He also would be fine if they didn't. So they're taking very hardline positions supporting whatever decisions are made by whoever.
There's an really interesting article on Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, in the Politico, which I think actually kind of sounds right, which is they've kind of put everything, secondary to their domestic agenda. To, you know, get through the infrastructure bill, get the voting rights, get the vote HR1, get all this stuff done. And everything else is that they're ignoring that. And their notion is, you know, this will make America strong. There's two problems with that strategy. If you want to keep Americans free, safe, and prosperous, you don't get credit for two out of three. You can't ignore what the rest of the world is doing. You can't ignore all this other stuff. You can't myopically focus on one thing and ignore the other stuff because you'll fail. But and the other thing is what they think will make America strong is wrong. So it's a we are in for a real buckle up your seatbelt roller coaster ride here.
If I could borrow a phrase from Emmanuel Cleaver, a real Satan sandwich you just described there. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Wiki at War, Private Sector Public Wars as well. Jim, thanks as always.
All right. You guys be good.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Amy, did you hear the story up in Glenview?
Todd about Stern, the beavers?
Yeah, Todd Stern, who lives at the Concord at the Glen in Glenview. I'm very upset. They're putting traps under the water to capture the beavers and drown them, which I think is absolutely terrible. Apparently, they use subscriptions to Oprah's book club in those traps. Now, my question
yes. Save the beavers? Is that your new hashtag?
Well, no.
Because I want to see you wearing a Save the Beavers t-shirt around town.
My question, just trying to get a sense of scale of the problem, is the problem Glenview has with nuisance beavers similar to the woke cougars problem in Hinsdale?
Nice beaver.
Thank you. I just had it stuffed.
Let me help you with that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know you're wondering, as we all are,
yes,
when are we going to get our Obama statue? You know, the one that I assume will be modeled after the Christ the Redeemer statue outside of Rio. You know, about 125 feet tall, lording over the city.
Well, Michael, where the Columbus statue was removed.
Well, it'd be perfect. I mean, as long as it's, you know, again, has the gravitas, the size to dominate the Chicago landscape.
Oh, yeah.
That's
five stories high.
Yeah, part of our Obamaland development. And the indication you would get from the Chicago press corps, the government press corps, obviously in liege with Obama world, is that the project is full speed ahead and all of the legal matters have been resolved. But that's not the case. We've been following the story. We've talked to our next guest before. We talked to his counsel, one of the great legal minds in the Western world, Richard Epstein. He is Herb Kaplan, Protect Our Parks, and he wants to update us on the next round of litigation involving the location of said Obama land. Herb, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. So you're not done putting in this fight on behalf of the parks and, and frankly, the near south side.
Yeah, definitely not. I'll give you all the details. But first, when you refer to the size of what they want to put into Jackson Park, that's going to be a 235-foot tower. It's going to be taller than any other building in the near south side. And it's going to have virtually no impact on the well-being of people who live on the south side of Chicago. Now, as far as what's happening legally, all the newspapers, you were quite right in referring to publications talking about the Obama Foundation breaking ground. The stories first reported, and I guess it was due to their press releases, was they were going to start breaking ground in April. Then they changed it to say they were going to start breaking ground in September. But the reality is that as long as the lawsuit filed by Protect Our Parks continues, and it is continuing, they're not going to be breaking any ground until that lawsuit is completed. And at the moment, we have a petition for certiorari before the U.S. Supreme Court, which by itself will be the final decision on the merits of the case. But regardless of that, because of the recent proceedings by federal authorities that under federal law, the environmental and historic preservation law, local authorities are supposed to determine whether any damage to historic Jackson Park could be avoided by relocating the proposed Obama Center to another location.
Let me just stop you there for a second, since you just mentioned a petition for cert before the Supreme Court. Remind us what the constitutional issue is that would support your petition for a Supreme Court hearing.
Well, there were two issues that were raised in the Seventh Circuit appeal that was decided. One had to do with standing to sue, and the other had to do with whether there was a federal issue that came within the jurisdiction of the court. And we're going to be challenging both of those issues. But with respect to jurisdiction of the court, which I think the Supreme Court would be most interested in, we're relying on the Fifth Amendment, which provides for the transfer of land without compensation. So we think there's a definite federal issue that's decided in addition to the rule of law under state statutes, so that although we have no idea what's going to happen in the Supreme Court now, because Amy Barrett, the new justice to the Supreme Court, is the judge who wrote the opinion in the Seventh Circuit case. Mm-hmm. So she'll have to abstain on our petition for certiorari, which means we will then be confronted with an 8-judge panel that will decide on whether or not to take up the case on our appeal. And getting a majority of those 8 judges is uncertain. That's why, regardless of what the Supreme Court might do, we're filing an altogether new lawsuit. There'll be an announcement of it within a day or two, based on new issues that arose out of that, the federal review. So that means that regardless of what the Supreme Court does, that there's continuing litigation that will bar the Obama Center from doing anything in Jackson Park until all the litigation is resolved.
Why are they digging in their heels and refusing to leave Jackson Park?
You know, I have no idea. It makes no sense, because if all the promises that were made by the Obama Foundation about benefits that are going to accrue to people living on the South Side and to the city, by the construction of an Obama Center, Protect Our Parks is all in favor of the construction of an Obama Center, as long as it's not in this protected historic Jackson Park. And if the Obama Foundation wanted to start breaking ground and start construction, if they would just agree to relocate to any of the number of choice alternative sites on the South Side that we've identified, they could start building tomorrow. And I have the feeling that Obama is really trying to piggyback on the reputation of Jackson Park, which already is an established tourist destination. It doesn't need the presence of this 235-foot Obama honor statue tower in order to attract the tourists. So,
and I'm sure they like it because it's along the lakefront in Jackson Park.
Well, that's part of it. But the alternative site that we've proposed in the Washington Park neighborhood is, you know, just a few blocks further west than Jackson Park, and would provide all the same benefits. And also, by building in Washington Park neighborhood, it would benefit the people who definitely live in Washington Park and need a neighborhood that needs new investment and development. Whereas building in Jackson Park does nothing for the residents nearby, except it, what it has done is attract all the real estate sharks to come in and raise the rents of people currently living in local neighborhoods and converting rental apartments into pricey condominiums, in effect driving out the people who are currently living in those neighborhoods on the south side that adjoin Jackson Park, and clearing them out altogether.
So what? I mean, I understand why a living God among us like President Obama would want his Acropolis, Chicago's Acropolis, wherever he wants it. I mean, if he wanted to display Soldier Field, and Soldier Field should be raised in the Obama land, should be put there, as far as I'm concerned, of course. That's the posture of the majority of Chicagoans, so I just want to go along, get along. But why so litigious, Herb? Why, you know, I know there's some issues you raised and some rents and people being pushed out, and there could be a better spot for it in terms of economic activity and in an area on the south side that needs more infusion of opportunity. But what is the fundamental issue here? Why not just let it go and let the president have what he wants?
Well, we're happy to have the Obamas decide where they would prefer to have their 235-foot tower. But the reality is the Obamas are also concerned about his legacy. And part of that legacy is his formally championing the need and right of citizens to have open, clear, and free public parks.
Oh,
and
sure.
By insisting on Jackson Park, he's going back not only on his own prior promises about, loving nature and loving public parks.
Yeah, imagine Obama. Imagine Obama going back on promises. I perished the thought. But you're not concerned about Obama's legacy. You're not trying to protect Obama's legacy with this. What is the fundamental issue for you and protect our parks with the choice they've made and why you've been litigating this for years?
Well, for two reasons. First of all, the public park system along the lakefront only exists because of long and hard legal battles to keep the real estate exploiters and commercial developers out of that that land. And what the land that's in Jackson Park is protected by statute. And the proposal to build there is in total violation of all those statutes. So, we are concerned with actually having an Obama Center, and we're actually also concerned about honoring the former president. And in that sense, we're also concerned about his legacy not being diminished by him undertaking something that's against the public interest. And we've tried all along to have, discussions, rational discussions, to consider an alternative site, which would succeed in providing all the benefits that the Obamas want, but at the same time would also benefit the interests of the local residents who are living in the Washington Park neighborhood. It would be a win for, and it also ties in exactly with Mayor Lightfoot's plan for developing underserved south side neighborhoods. Identified one of those south side neighborhoods. And it's also a south side neighborhood where Obama was formerly a community organizer. So you would think he would want to go back.
Yeah, it's almost
back
like
into that neighborhood. Let's face it, he was not a community organizer in Jackson Park. Jackson Park exceeded him by 127 years and established it its own reputation and its own attraction, being a tourist attraction.
It's wild, isn't it?
World famous.
It's wild. It's almost like this is all about the Obamas and nobody else. What a shocking development. Well, rational conversations and the rule of law. Good luck with those in Chicago. This is why I guess you're petitioning the Supreme Court, because they're hard to find, those rational conversations, incidents of the rule of law over the rule of men in the city. So we applaud your efforts, you and Richard Epstein. Herb Kaplan, president of Protect Our Parks, protectourparks.org is the website. Herb, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
That's correct. And I just repeat, keep tuned, because we have a number of things that we're going to be announcing to further advance the relocation of the Obama Center.
Okay. Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How to woke-proof your kids by Peachy Keenan. I have a feeling that is a gnome de plume. Writing in the American Mind. She's one mom who has one. How to woke-proof your kids. You ready?
Yep. Should I be taking notes?
Yeah. We're digging a 300-square-foot bunker suitable for young children. It's hard work. My back isn't what it used to be. So far, we're 50 feet down in the backyard, about to pour 10-inch thick Wi-Fi-proof concrete walls. The kids will have goldfish coloring books, a Kindle that contains all of Western classical lit Play-Doh, and a hose for drinking water. They'll be lowered into the hole when they turn 6, and we'll let them climb out when they turn 18. The new woke-proofing program. She should put together a kit, and a checklist. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Cruel, you say? Not if you're trying to insulate your precious children from the all-powerful wokeness algorithm. In fact, it's the only way to be sure. We'll miss them. Well, will I miss them? Sure. But I'm comforted knowing they'll be among the few who survived the radioactive wokelier fallout released this year. She goes on to say actual rules for woke-proofing your kids, the actual rules, and she's not literally putting them in a bunker underneath her home. Speak truth to gender and never shut up. Mm-hmm. When it comes to gender, beware. Lack of confidence and moral uncertainty in otherwise normal educated parents have given the pronoun people an easy port of entry into your child's hungry cortex, and they're rushing into the breach. Despite what the clowns running the circus want you to think, it actually is possible to be 100% certain which sex, I would say, not gender, sex your baby will identify with, as long as you commit as a parent to stopping entry of brainworms. Fake gender identities are a modern progressive social epidemic induced by the internet, so it requires some avoidance technique to prevent this infection. Shun gender neutrality. Dress your girls like ladies and your boys like off-duty firemen. If your little boy wants to request to wear a dress to school, tell him firmly that boys do not wear dresses, only girls do, and you refuse to allow him to entertain fantasy notions. My son thought he was Buzz Lightyear for years and wore Buzz pajamas daily, including preschool. He grew out of it before we went forward with his Space Ranger reassignment surgery. How about that?
My son thought he was Thomas the Tank Engine for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and his brother was Percy. I'm like, yeah, no, that's all right, but he grew out of it, yes.
So that's one, truth about sex, identity. So this is something everybody can do. Will you? I mean, our listeners, generally speaking, will, but will you put it to those within your circles of influence, as I'm always wont to point?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Second, two easy ones. Teach abortion as a horror movie. Abortion is a gateway drug for the left, the best one they ever devised. Lucky for us, it works both ways. Once a child decides that abortion is freedom or health care or justice, it's easy to get them to sign on to the rest of the woke agenda. But once they understand what abortion entails on the procedure table, what the aborted remains are, they can almost never be turned to the dark side. Remind your kids that unborn children are alive and are humans just like they were when they were in your womb. You can say, imagine if I'd aborted your youngest sibling. Lots of women do that, you know. They just don't want another baby. Or tell them the story of the good friend who reduced her triplets to twins. Mm-hmm. She goes on to say, once a child understands what a fetus actually is, they are highly unlikely to ever take part in destroying one. And best of all, for reasons I don't fully understand, the pro-life mindset tends to open the door to other right-leaning ideas. Absolutely correct. Absolutely the key point. A key point, not the, but A, the life is the key point. Opening the door to other right-leaning ideas. This is, I've said this before, why do people always say, "Are you know, what's your view on life? What's your view on 2A? Conservatives ask those questions first a lot. Because if you're right on those issues, you're like 99% going to be right on most of the other issues, the fiscal issues in particular. And if you're wrong on those issues, you're likely to be a catastrophe. Three, channel your inner patriotic boomer. America 2021 is a weak nation being run into the ground by blinker nincompoops and evil nihilists. But it wasn't always so. Despite my current status as a cynical dissident in my own land, I have no choice but to double down on patriotic propaganda for my prepubescent set. Think about how your parents felt when they saw Saving Private Ryan, or how your grandfather cried at the neighborhood 4th of July parade. Mostly these old vets were crying for their dead friends lost in forgotten battles. But she goes on to say, for now, while my children are under my roof, we celebrate the incredible generosity of Americans, our glorious military history, respect the flag, and so on and so forth. Easy things. I mean, is there anything difficult here? One, two, three, and four. So one, sex, identity, moral clarity on it. Two, abortion as a horror movie. Make your kids understand what a child in the womb is, a child. Three, patriotic, not jingoistic, but patriotic. Four, radically rehab your entertainment diet. Ban new books. Encourage the classics. Avoid new music, especially since stars popular children are prone to making porn, you know, for kids, of themselves, giving Beelzebub a rub and tug. Right.
Humping the ground, yes.
New movies are all terrible, but who cares? Stick to the 80s classics where men are men and women are Kathleen Turner. Die Hard, The Matrix, Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places, Ghostbusters, so on and so forth. You get it. Five, make wokeness cringe. Our friends over at the Pop Culture Factory are doing most of the heavy lifting with this one. Everything wokeness touches turns to cringe in the end. Even America's favorite celebrities get debased lower and lower until they become unpaid propaganda ministers for the regime. Help them along by consistently helping your kids see that these influencers are losers, soy boys, and psychotics, and you should always do the opposite of what they tell you to do. Mock LeBron James and Miley Cyrus and Joe Biden and Meghan Markle and the woke agenda mercilessly. It's lame. Never interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake, and boy, are they. Can you do those five things? Mock them, like the Sports Illustrated gender fluid model that's up for the swimsuit editions. You see that?
Yeah.
It's a dude.
I know, but I had to look close.
Well, it's a soy. I mean, it's perfect for the soy boy generation, which is this author's point. Five things you want. I'll kid. You know, yes, you want to fight the battle in the schools too, because they have influence. But the five things you can do to woke proof your kids, pretty straightforward, pretty easy, isn't it? 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line, 64636 DA turnkey.pro text line, Ralph and Rantoul.
Hey there, good morning. So I was finishing a business conference at Lake Tahoe and flew my family out. So we're enjoying this very swank buffet breakfast. We served ourselves at the top of some nice hotel, Lake Tahoe, overlooking the lake, Sierra Nevada. So we got done serving ourselves, and my four-year-old daughter, we said, Grace, we're starting to eat. And she's eating, and she stops, and she looks up at me, and she says, Daddy, when is the man going to come around and ask us how our food is? And I turned and I looked at my wife and I said, we're going camping.
Thanks, Ralph. Terry in Rogers Park.
Shouldn't a parent have the right to not let their child attend a sex education class in public schools?
Well, I mean, religious exception. Thanks for the call, Terry.
I was just shocked when in kindergarten. they were learning sex education.
By the way, in the whole LGBTQ plus, we just got a call from one of our leftist nincompoops that is described in this article. Did you just advocate banning books? Was John from Mundelein's comment? This guy's a colossal D-bag and some idler who lives in his basement and like writes folk music like Eric Zorn or something. A soy boy from one of the original soy boys that's passed on to previous generations. In other words, human detritus. Terrible person. Moral clarity. Did you just advocate banning books? No, I didn't advocate banning books. This woman in her article said, you know, we're going to ban the books, keep the books out of my children's hands that the indoctrinators want them to read exclusively, and we're going to start with the classics. You understand, John from Mundelein, you are the goon, you are the thug, you are the barbarian, you are the book banner, and the banner of all things you disagree with. That's the posture of the totalitarian left in 2021 America. Thank you for trying, though. And this pushback, by the way, you start with woke-proofing your kids and then woke-proof your school, particularly ones you support. Loyola Academy, let's return to Wilmette.
What are they doing now?
They're getting pressure, more pressure. A good Fox News story over the weekend that they may have violated the terms of the $5 million in PPP money the school got under the CARES Act in April of last year, where contingent on accepting the money was obliging individuals' First Amendment rights.
Really?
May have violated the civil rights of conservative students. It's argued things like preventing the students from starting a Turning Point USA chapter there because one teacher told them Turning Point USA was anti-Semitic and racist. There was attempts to start at least one other conservative group on campus, Young Americas for Freedom, met with similar resistance. Uh-huh. Well, this continued pushback from parents, finally, here's an example, is working because yet another missive has gone out to parents, the Loyola Academy community, from outgoing president of the school, Patrick McGrath, father Patrick McGrath, and the chairman of the board, Nancy Parody. Oh, and this is just delightful. Among the questions that people have is, are diversity and inclusion efforts. Yeah. We've received inquiries and comments about the school's efforts in the areas of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Do it in the proper acronymic order. Diversity, inclusion, and equity. Die. Better. Everything we do at Loyola must be grounded in our Catholic Jesuit mission. We don't always do this work perfectly, and so on and so forth. And so they're going to do more surveying, self-study process. Uh-huh. This is what they do. Mm-hmm. Elicit input from constituencies in the school, including parents.
Oh,
it's nice to include constituencies of the school, including parents. Nice to include the parents. Among the recommendations of the most recent review is for Loyola to dedicate itself to important questions about diversity. Yeah. Promote a greater sense of belonging, connection, challenging conversations regarding race, gender, and politics. And this is all about, this is precipitated by this Peter Jansen, I guess is his name, this teacher there, who did this, apologize for your white privilege assignment. One of the greatest blessings of the Loyola community is our diversity of students, different parts of Chicago, different backgrounds, blah, 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 blah. Pap. Absolute pap. It's embarrassing, actually. And but they're feeling the heat, which is why you're getting these missives. And now you get the chairman of the school's board along with Father McGrath. Well, I've seen one letter in response to this, and I haven't been given the okay to share who it is, but he is a substantial donor like, you know, has got a family, foundation. He's at that level of philanthropy. And he supports, and his family supports a lot of Catholic institutions, Cristo Rey and others, scholarship programs for minority students. This is somebody who's otherwise interested in investing in living out his faith. Well, he's not going to be investing in Loyola until they turn, until they get their act around. He specifically cited things like teachers saying a Turning Point USA was anti-Semitic. He said, well, that would be interesting if the teacher could explain to Ben Shapiro, who supports Turning Point USA, why Turning Point USA is anti-Semitic. This individual requested that a gift plaque that's located in the piazza at Loyola be removed. Removed from all donor lists, all future financial support solicitations from the school. He is. This guy is a substantial contributor and, as I said, somebody that is now acting philanthropically consistent with his beliefs. That's something else everybody can do to woke insulate their children, their family, the institutions they attended, the institutions they support, not just limited to schools, but including schools, to make a big impact. And when some of the bigger fish, in terms of dollars, start to do that, now all of a sudden you have the snowball rolling downhill a bit. And again, don't believe that these letters would be sent out trying to contextualize what they're doing at Loyola Academy if they weren't feeling the political and financial cultural pressure from the parents and the donors. So good for whoever it is, including the gentleman who shall go unnamed that I'm referencing, good for them for stepping up and providing an example. Hopefully other parents and families and donors will follow. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Footnote on Loyola Academy and Wilmette.
Yep.
Don't think just because a heavy hitter is involved now that the fight is over. Now build upon that, and because you're still getting missives from the president and the school board chairman that are full of identitarian gibberish that is not consistent with Catholicism, the catechism, or Catholic education. Diversity takes care of itself when we're in the business of building men and women of character. The diversity piece takes care of itself. We're in the character building business. And until Catholic schools like Loyola get to that place, then they are far afield. So build upon this pressure that is working at Loyola Academy. Loyola Academy parents, alumni, coaches that are there now would be nice. Anybody and everybody.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You could win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we've got two high-profile police-involved shootings, one that happened yesterday in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis, that has now necessitated scrambling the National Guard there to quell the rioting and looting.
Yeah, 24 establishments, Verizon stores, big box stores were looted last night.
A 20-year-old named Dante Wright was stopped by police, as his mom says, because he had an air freshener dangling from his rearview mirror, which is, you know, a violation of code there. But that has not been confirmed by police in terms of why the stop occurred. Apparently, according to police, there was a warrant out for Mr. Wright, and something happened where he fled. The police officer shot, killed him, and the protesting ensued. There is a reported body and dash cam video that has not been made public yet, and on that score, we're waiting for the body cam video from the Adam Toledo police-involved shooting, the 13-year-old who was shot the other week. that is going to be released in the coming days to the public after apparently his family gets a chance to view it per Mayor Triple Threat. But it was described in court per the video by prosecutors. The description includes that the 13-year-old Adam Toledo had a gun in his hand. There's gunpowder residue found on his hands, and when the police officer told him to drop the gun, he turned toward the police officer with the gun in his hand, and that's when he was shot.
And apparently, because I talked to somebody who saw the video, they said as he was turning, he was dropping the gun, so there's a still picture of not a gun in his right hand or his left hand, but the gun falling. But this is after a pursuit, Dan, that went on for a few blocks, so they're saying, drop your weapon, drop your weapon.
Well, we'll see about that. We'll see if the prosecutor's description checks out when the video is made public. But assuming it does, I'm not sure that it matters in terms of the politician's posture towards police in the coming months with the Chauvin trial ongoing and moving towards conclusion. And then more of those police officers that were former police officers that were involved with the George Floyd stop and death being tried after him. Our friend Jason Johnson, the former deputy commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department, now with the Legal Enforcement Defense Fund, notes, last year, the United States tallied more than 20,000 murders, the highest total since 1995. Preliminary FBI data for 2020 points to a 25% surge in murders, the largest single year-over-year increase since the agency began publishing uniform data in 1960. And he writes, policing is to blame, the lack of it. And this is where we're going as Portland doesn't know whether it wants to follow Ted Wheeler's call for more money for the police to stop the just sort of ongoing violence and vandalism and Antifa control of parts of that city, or if they want to hire park rangers to replace police. Which way is this going to go? The way that it seems to be trending in big cities and not so big cities is police on their heels. No proactive policing. You're there to be a videographer. And we'll let social workers and park rangers do the peacekeeping. Well, let's talk to our friend Raphael Mengual about how that is likely to work out based on what we know from what we've seen as Jason Johnson was describing in his op-ed in the USA Today. Raphael Mengual is a expert in this space. We've talked to him many times. He's a senior fellow and deputy director of legal policy at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, contributing editor of City Journal as well. Raphael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Dan, and Amy again.
So, what's the, there's, competing explanations for the spike in violent crime that Jason Johnson wrote about, that you wrote about in The Hill. Over 2020, over 2019, how do you suss it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jason's absolutely onto something with respect to the claim about policing playing a role here. I mean, one of the things that we've seen over the last several years, and this is predating the pandemic, which is sort of one of the go-to explanations for people who don't want to deal with the possibility that, this crime problem is something that's going to be with us for a while. Is that if you look at the number of police officers in the country, that number has been dropping pretty steadily for at least 4 or 5 years prior to 2020. So between 2013 and 2016, the number of full-time sworn police officers in the country dropped by 3.2%. It's now significantly under 700,000. For the first time, basically since the mid to late 90s, when you consider the fact that the U.S. population has increased, during that period of time, the sort of ratio of civilians to police officers has become more unfavorable. I think it stands to reason, given all the research showing the connection between the number of police on the beat and crime, that a significant decline in the number of police officers leading up to 2020 sort of set the stage for the crime increase that we saw. And then, in 2020, the protests, not only caused an even more troubling spike in retirements, it also caused this, sort of tendency to for cities to sort of placate the crowd and defund their departments to some degree. And in New York, we know, for example, that included canceling an entire academy class, It also had that same effect in Los Angeles, and I'm sure it did in other cities that, you know, that experimented with this. So what you've got is, you know, a sort of pre-existing trend of police officer, the number of police officers declining. You've got this new trend of protests kind of accelerating the rate at which people want to leave that job. You've also got this defund movement that is making it harder to sort of fill the gap, the growing hole that a lot of cities are experiencing. And then with the police officers that are left on the beat, I mean, they're, you know, getting spit at, cursed out, you know, depicted in the media as evil murderers. It creates a sense of fear, I think, within departments that if they get out of the car and they're proactive and they do their job, they're putting themselves an undue risk. And if they make a mistake in the field, they're not going to get a fair shake. And that's not an entirely unreasonable reaction to all of this. And so, you know, I think what we've got is this kind of, you know, really deadly cocktail on the policing side that basically not only decreased the number of cops, but decreased their willingness to be proactive. And those are two things that we know are really very closely associated with crime law.
How does the pandemic play in this? And I ask that because, you know, in Washington, D.C., those two girls who carjacked and ended up killing that Muslim Uber Eats driver, they should have been in school. You have 103,000 high schoolers that are still, you know, not a lot of them are not checking in on e-learning, and carjackings are up 238% in Chicago. And some of them, not almost half, though, are in their young teens. One girl as young as 12 carjacked people here in the streets of Chicago. So do you think that plays a part in this?
Yeah, no, I think it does to some degree. I mean, the research on the effect of, you know, school closures and crime is somewhat mixed. So what we see is that, you know, when school's out, you do see a lot more adolescents involved in more kinds of property crime. That sometimes includes car thefts. Carjacking, though, is a bit of a different sort of thing. And this, you know, sort of explosion is I think, unexpected for a lot of people in carjacking. This is more of a violent crime that requires, you know, a significant amount of force or threat of force. One of the things that we do see with school closures is that more kind of interpersonal violent crime, homicides, aggravated assaults tend to go down because there is some evidence showing that schools are actually criminogenic environments, at least in high crime neighborhoods. So, you know, within school hallways, you're more likely to sort of develop beefs that then sort of boil over into fights and then, you know, other kinds of violence. But I do think the pandemic played a role, you know, to some degree with school closures contributing to at least some of the crimes that we're seeing. I also think it played a role in the sense that at least early on, you know, part of the pullback on the part of police might just have been a function of protocols, you know, fear of sort of exposing oneself, to this really harmful disease. We saw the police officers were contracting COVID at much higher rates. And so I think that was, you know, certainly something that came into play, but also the criminal justice system more broadly kind of came to a halt for a while, right? So it took a lot longer to get cases from charging to disposition. You saw a lot of COVID-related prison releases, a lot of COVID-related jail diversions. So this all contributed to the number of sort of offenders on the street rather than behind bars, which I also think played a role. But, you know, that's not the kind of thing that a lot of people who cite the pandemic as a cause are pointing to. Rather, what they like to argue is that, you know, a la AOC, the pandemic sort of created this economic desperation that led people down this path to violent crime that they wouldn't have otherwise gone down. And that's an argument for which I don't see a ton of evidence. I mean, for one thing, if you just, you know, take my home city of New York, for example, and just look at the poverty rate, like the year before New York City had its record high murder year in 1990 with 2,262 murders, the poverty rate was actually slightly lower than it was in 2016, which is the year before we hit a record low for murders, which is just 292 for that year. And of course, during the Great Recession, the national homicide rate declined by 15%, going from 5.7 per 100,000 to 4.8. During that same time, the civilian unemployment rate skyrocketed. It almost doubled from 4.6 to 9.3. So, you know, this is
that's a bunch of right. She's well, of course, it's nonsense. It's coming from the likes of AOC. But look, I mean, first of all, household incomes have gone up during the pandemic because of all the funny money. That's number one, to your point about the poverty rate. Number two, the unemployment spike is driven by women having to go back home and look after kids. And they're not committing very many crimes, particularly violent crimes. and those making $40,000 a year that are grinding it out and trying to climb the ladder. I mean, that's just a bunch of silliness. And frankly, some of the school stuff is too, because as you point out, these schools as sort of sanctuaries of safety and institutions of learning. Well, that is a huge lie that hopefully has been exposed finally to a greater percentage of the population with what they've seen on Zoom calls for those that are even checking in for their Zoom calls or their Zoom classes. I mean, that is all a bunch of nonsense by people holding on to institutions that have been completely, at least based on the evidence, delegitimized during the pandemic.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, the other thing too is if you look at just, you know, the economic effects of the pandemic, they were pretty widespread, right? I mean, it's not as if everyone, and this is one of the things that complicates that argument, right? Because the crime increase, we know, as always, is coming from a very small slice of our population. It is concentrated in a very small slice of the, you know, of the country.
Right.
And this is, and, you know, a much smaller slice than has been affected by the pandemic.
Right. And I mean, let's just be clear here. You know, those two girls that carjacked that Uber driver in D.C., you think they had some great respect for life and the rule of law when they were in school a year ago and they just sort of descended into Clockwork Orange in the last year because they're not in school? No, these are kids that got a problem to begin with and violent tendencies to begin with, and you're just seeing the expression of them and you want to blame it on something that runs concurrent even though it has no causal link.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, too, that went on in the country that, you know, I didn't put in the Hill piece, but that, you know, I think people ought to know about is that there's been a pretty steady level of decarceration across the country leading up to 2020. If you look at just 2018 and 2019, and look at the number of states in which the prison population was declining, this is a vast majority of the country. You had 38 states cut their prison rolls in 2019, 34 states cut their prison rolls in 2018. And if you just, you know, look at, the overall level of decarceration in the last 10 years from 2009 to 2019, the prison population across the country dropped almost 20%. This is going to have an effect on things. And I think one of the problems is that the crime increase of 2020 that was coupled with the pandemic, I think the fact that it came alongside the pandemic is clouding people's sort of openness to the possibility that some of these other criminal justice factors might be playing.
Well, and the decarceration is part of it. Now we're getting to the other side of the criminal justice system and the non-prosecution prosecutors. The slap on the hands at most for property crimes aren't real crimes, and so on and so forth. That sort of philosophy among all these big city non-prosecution prosecutors, Kim Fox, Gesson, Krasner, Bowden in San Francisco, Mosby in Baltimore, and so on and so forth.
That's exactly right. I mean, the progressive prosecutor trend is really something that, you know, I think Americans ought to be troubled by. I mean, we're at a point now in our country where almost 40 million Americans are living in jurisdictions with progressive prosecutors who have, you know, openly dedicated themselves to pursuing decarceration for its own sake. And, you know, if you look at some of the cities in which, these prosecutors are in office, Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, you know, under Larry Krasner, the homicide total has gone up every year since he's been in office. And of course, Baltimore recently set its all-time record for homicide rate. And yet Marilyn Mosby is on Twitter right now trying to tell me that things are okay. And so, you know, it really is. I mean, I kid you not, she literally just tweeted at me. So it really is a kind of strange gaslighting of the United States where you have these people, pursuing these policies that, you know, we know do have a downside risk associated with them, yet no one seems willing to connect the dots between those sorts of policies and approaches and the sort of crime increases that a lot of these jurisdictions have been seeing since before the pandemic year.
Rafael Mangual, Senior Fellow, Deputy Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor of City Journal as well. Check out his piece in The Hill, which I tweeted out or will tweet out. Cities got deadlier in 2020. Maybe I'll get Marilyn Mosby to respond to me too. Rafael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yep, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.